grab your highlighters. Can't find them? They're probably right there in your pocket protector. It's time for that Early Childhood Nerd Podcast. Let's get nerdy. Here's Heather.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of That Early Childhood Nerd. I'm Heather Burnt-Santi, recovering from RSV. And joining me today is Lisa Murphy. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. Hello. First recording with you in the new office.
And the new office. Yay. Okay. So we're talking about structure today, right? We're going to rant a little bit. I predict strong feelings and opinions.
Entirely different things, but yes.
Our opening quote, actually Lisa's going to read it because I didn't have one ready and she does. So it's from her book, Lisa Murphy on Being Child-Centered.
Everybody. Well, and I think I want to lead with full disclosure. I have a sneaking suspicion this episode might be a shameless self-promotion.
All of them are for me. I mean,
Fair enough. So I'm on page 94 of the Being Child-Centered book. One of the suggestions I have for all of you reading the book is to spend some time defining, investigating, pondering, unpacking, whatever word works for you, the idea of control versus structure. Being child-centered means there is structure, boundaries, and among other things, consistency. What has been intentionally reduced and removed is the adult's need, desire, and attempt to control the children. Mm-hmm. I could read this whole paragraph, but yeah. I think that's a nice launch pad.
Yeah, I do too. I know this comes from a chat we were all having in the Nerd Facebook group. But we hear this all the time, both of us, I'm sure, that children need structure, that idea that children need structure, and people use that as sort of a defense for traditional regimented schedules with very tight transitions and adult leadership in all of those decisions that come into that kind of a day. You know, I think what you did there with your quote from your book is use, you know, a little bit of different language, different vocabulary to shift our thinking into what it is that children really do need and benefit from. And it's not necessarily control and regimentation. I don't know if regimentation is a word. It is now.
And I think like with all of our evolution and our processes of changing our mind and everything, the first order of business is realizing that we might have been using the words interchangeably, or not even realizing, because I mean, again, speaking from the experience, after a gig, people constantly come up, oh, this was great. We had so much fun, but our program is so much more structured. Yeah. And I always go like, pause. And they're like, pause. I'm like, pause. I said, paint me a picture of what you mean by structured. And, you know, and again, this is not any judgy finger pointing, not at all. It's just, you know, when I ask them to paint me a clear picture, 99% of the time of the scenario or whatever is all control.
Right.
It's control. And a lot of times they just haven't even seen, you know, that, oh, wow, maybe those two words do mean two different things. And I love the idea of the lens shift because I knew out the gate that it was going to be very, very important in this book to really like do a deeper dive and show just how the words are different, that it's not just semantics. Right. It's not just verbiage.
Yeah. And I think it just comes from, I'll say specifically American childcare culture. I suspect it's similar in other places, but I don't live and work there, so I can't say that for sure. That we hear a phrase like, oh, children benefit from having structure, and we have in our mind our cultural interpretation of what a child's day should be when they're in an early childhood program, which usually comes from our memories of school or our images of school. And we just put those two things together to say, oh, yes, okay, children benefit from a structured environment. And this is a structured environment. So they must benefit from this school-like situation we've got set up. And because nobody has ever said, wait, what do you mean? Wait, what could that look like? Why do you think that's what structure is? You know, we have these scripts in our culture that make the connection automatically, and why would we pause to think about it differently unless someone...
Because Lisa Murphy told you to.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Like, I definitely early on had my daily schedule regimented out and everything was done in a group, and I was the one in charge and making the decisions because I was the teacher.
Did you sneeze or cough?
I coughed. Okay. I don't know if I hit mute in time or not. Sorry, everyone.
In case you're only listening, she pressed the mute button.
Anyway, I think what I'm saying is I'm trying to just agree and say I don't think anyone, as I've said many times, wakes up in the morning rubbing their hands together thinking, how can I control and dehumanize children today?
We like to think that
it makes
nobody
sense until it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to think nobody does that, but you know.
Surely no one listening to this show does.
Right? We're preaching to the choir. So, and one of the things I like about preaching to the choir is that it probably offers some empowerment and some affirmation and perhaps a little bit of new vocabulary
for sure.
The choir to go back and talk to the people who aren't choosing, right, to
or
come and
to throw into one of your classes.
Exactly. So in the book, if you indulge me, I defined those two words, which for the sake of conversation, I mean, I know you've read the book. So in the book, I talked about, you know, even just a non-scholarly Google search of just looking for definitions of control and structure. And with structure, you got words and phrases like having a plan, being organized, a model to guide some decisions, to arrange according to a plan, to have a pattern or organization. And controlling gave you phrases like being in charge, determining someone's behavior, to direct, manage, supervise, to command, to dominate. And then you also got links to pages that address how a controlling personality can lead to the development of toxic relationships. So that went down like an entirely different rabbit hole. But when you think, even when bring it back to early childhood, and we know the value of relationships, right? And so, yes, that might sound kind of snarky in a book for adults, but you know, if you have somebody in a very controlling mindset working with young children, that will undermine the relationships that you're going to have. And what I have found is the use of specific examples assists folks in dialing in, like, you know, quick flash in the pan, stuck in the elevator. You got a mom who's like, what do you mean there's a difference between structure and control? Boom. So in the book, I have a bunch of different scenarios, like standing up at circle time, taking your shoes off, standing up during snack or lunch, walking down the hallway, where the control piece is with, by golly, come hell or high water, you have to keep your shoes on. That's control. Now you have an adult trying to control a child, which we know can't happen. But the structure, the freedom within the structure, is that if you want to take your shoes off, there's a procedure. And I think the thing that's amazingly important is that, yes, there is a procedure. So you sit down and you take off your shoes, you take off your socks, you put your socks inside your shoes, you put your shoes in the shoebox. We use like a busboy restaurant tub as the shoebox. And then when you were done being barefoot, you did the cycle in reverse, and nobody got all bent out of shape about it. And, you know, all of this dances so tight with what we always say about controlling the environment instead of the child. And the closer we get to shedding the need to be the boss of everything. I mean, I think we've probably said 1,000 times to each other, you know, you're going to land in a place of being, of loving your job even more than you probably already do. So there's still routine. There's still predictability. There are still expectations, but my mood as the adult in the room does not dictate whether or not your shoes can come off today. And that's, I think, a subtle piece that we learn to start to see, that you're allowed to take your shoes off whether I'm in a good mood or not. That's the structure. You're muted.
Good thing I did my thinking face so you could tell me yes. I was muted. I think that a lot of times when I'm having this conversation with people, they think that the reason children need structure is so that they feel safe and they know what to expect. And children absolutely need to feel safe. What I see a lot of times when a classroom, an adult in an early childhood program, classroom, home, whatever it is, feels like structure means rules and right. expectations mean you follow my rules or else. And that becomes a very unsafe place for specific for most of the children, but for there's always a handful that place is always going to feel sort of emotionally unsafe because I'm always in trouble because I can't maintain these rules developmentally or whatever the reason is. I'm not able to meet these expectations. And the answer
and
to that is
not
more structure. The answer to that is, wait, I need to stop and think about what emotional safety, what safety really means in this space. And of course, it's tied to relationships. And I think it's also tied to what you just said about teachers then enjoying their jobs more because they've let go of some of that control and recognize that there still can be structure without control. Because they're not spending every second correcting children or wondering why this behavior won't stop.
Right.
So their stress level isn't getting to that point where those children are feeling unsafe because of the control.
Yeah. And I think it all initially emerged out of just realizing that, for me anyway, the entry point into unpacking control versus structure started way back in the beginning when of doing workshops, because I would say to an audience, you know, I'm Lisa Murphy and I'm play-based and child-centered. And you would instantly see half the audience start to watch that video in their head of, you know, kids naked running around with paint flying them through the air and complete chaos and anarchy. And that's the trust piece, right? Which then dances with the relationship piece. My licensor, when I was doing family child care, got very, very, very upset about the shoebox, like that, like you could see her body just like physically react to this. And I was like, you know, it's not like there's shoes and socks all over the place, right? That we can't find their belongings, that we're being disrespectful. Like, no, like give me some credit. Yeah. There is routine, there is predictability. Right. And to really comment or dovetail on what you were just saying about the behavior stuff. So with the shoebox scenario, just as an easy example, we would have kids that like the first time they were like new to the program, you know, they were running around barefoot all day because they were so used to this being a trigger for somebody. But once they acclimated and recalibrated and realized that this is just what happens here, and the boss lady doesn't seem to care whether my shoes are on or off or not, but I know what to do. Then they would never take their shoes off again. Right. It's like, so what, and what maybe historically for that particular child was a invitation for a power struggle. Like that kid realized, I don't need to worry about this. I can go about the business of being two and three, and four and five. And that's, you were using the language of emotionally, you know, safe. And I think that's what I'm saying when I say now they can go about the business of being little, because they're not having to have their brain take up, is this allowed today? Can I do this today? What's her mood barometer today? You know, they don't need to do that because it's predictable.
Right. And the shoe thing is so relatable. And I, as soon as you said that at the, you know, whenever we started that part of this conversation, I could feel people's responses because I've had that conversation so many times. And but for me, it's an example of something that we really hold on to without really fully examining. And it makes sense on the surface. So we don't go like this whole conversation about structure and control. So in our case, when I was a director, it's not in licensing anywhere, but the fire marshal would come in and say, well, we want their shoes to be on and whatever. But the rationale is, well, if we have to get out of the building in a hurry, we want them to have their shoes on, right? But if it's like today in Indiana or in Lafayette, at least it's, you know, like 10 below or something like that. If I had to get out in a hurry, if I had to get a bunch of kids out in a hurry right now, they're going to be shoes on. They're not going to have their coats on. So if right. I'm following that rationale, we should be fully coated, gloved, scarved.
For any given moment.
For any given moment, in case we have to get out of the building in a hurry. So it's really, I think my goal for this conversation is, you know, maybe we don't answer everybody's problem, solve everybody's problems, but we invite people to ask that why. Why are we doing this? Who is it for? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? Who is it for? If it's for the fire marshal, he's not in my building again for a year. I can still have that goal of safely getting out of the building if I have my shoes all in a box.
Which is what we did. And, you know, for those of you who are listening, who have heard that full story, you know, the real original Mackenzie, who was in my class, was the boss of the shoe, because Mackenzies need jobs and they need real jobs. And Mackenzie knew that if the fire drill, whether it was a drill or something real, she knew it was her job to pick up the shoebox, and then we would go to the muster point, and, you know, then we were all well and good, you know?
Yeah.
And at that point, I mean, that's a slippery slope rabbit hole. At the end of the day, I got everybody out safely. If we have to deal with a pair of frozen feet, I mean, we'll figure that out, you know? Mm-hmm. And I realize that's dramatic and that's probably going to tick somebody off. And right. I realized that I, you know, created the shoebox when I was living in California, where, you know, a bad weather day was 65 and rainy. Yeah. So, you know, there's 99 variables that come into play, but I think the common sense and the trust and the relationship piece now, especially with the weather, if you're with talking to parents, you know, this is something that we do, and these are the benefits of doing it, and this is our plan of attack, and you're either going to trust that I always have the highest and best interest for your children in mind, or you're not. Like, at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to.
Well, I think too that we're underestimating children when we say we have to have a shoes on all the time rule, because one day it might be 10 below and there might be a fire drill. Instead of saying, I come in this morning to my group of children and someone starts to take their shoes off, and I'm going to say, today we have to do it differently. Today, because it's so cold, we're going to keep our shoes on. But because they have had that experience of being trusted to take their shoes off when it isn't as big of a deal.
Exactly.
And follow that structure
of knowing
where
the
shoes go. Yeah. Then they're more likely to say, oh, okay, I'll keep them on today then. You know what I mean? I think a lot of times our idea of structure and control comes from a place of underestimating children.
I like that.
Intellectually. I mean,
I like that.
We always have to be the same because they don't have a capability to understand that something might be different one day.
Well, and we are also assuming that pointing out that the weather was kind of bad that day is going to come from the adult. Like, maybe Jonathan runs in and is like, you know, my feet are really cold. And maybe then Mackenzie says, we should probably keep our shoes on. You know, just even assuming that the adult is the one that gets that ball rolling. And that really does come back to the control piece. I used to tell parents in the parent workshop, you know, there are days when you need to say, not need. There are days when you say, get in the van.
Yeah.
Like, get in the van. But because 95% of the time we can stop and look at the bug.
Yeah.
There's not going to be that pushback, which I think is, you know, we think we're trying to avoid power struggles and we end up.
We create them.
Creating.
And adults very rarely win them. Very rarely truly win a power struggle or come out of it feeling good about what they had to do to win it.
My ex-husband used to say that the child always wins a power struggle because eventually the adults just want them to be quiet.
Yeah.
They just want quiet.
So I want to go back a bit to what you said a little bit ago, like when you talk about this in workshops, because I think this is a piece of the resistance to letting children play more often. Is that, well, we're expected to have structure. We're expected to be in control of the classroom. And again, I'm using those words interchangeably as this person might be using them. So how do we help that person who feels like, I would love to give children more control and agency and be less bossy, but someone else is looking in and I need to always look like I'm in control.
Maybe that's an entry point word that breaks up with, not breaks up with, but instead of focusing on control and structure, maybe think about providing opportunities for choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it all dances together because a grown-up with a room full of children is going to be more comfortable, quote unquote, allowing children to have choice, facilitating choice if they have enough time.
Yeah.
Right? So if I still have that control piece of a 20-minute chopped up schedule, I'm going to be less inclined to feel that I have enough time to let children have that kind of choice. Mm-hmm. You know, so where is the actual starting spot, the initial point of entry that's going to allow the baby stepping towards relinquishing the control piece? And that's why time is the first one we unpack in the book and in the workshop, because the more time you have, the more time you have in the space, the more time children have to make choice, to have that sense of agency and mm-hmm. autonomy, mm-hmm. the easier it is to get to that place. 'Cause I'm not worried about anything else.
Yeah. I think even if you have that, if you're working in that place that says, you have to do this learning stuff. Here's your curriculum. You have to do it or whatever. I think there's space. A lot of this, I think, comes from when we're talking about daily schedules and control and structure. A lot of it comes from this idea that learning happens from 9 to 11.
Yeah, that's true.
Because if you look at one of those schedules, typically a lot of the 20-minute chop, chop, chop stuff is in the morning. And then we have wide free play, center choice, whatever you call it, in the afternoon. And we send in those at the end of the day, you know, we send in the staff that, you know, aren't the teachers or whatever you want to say. Typically speaking, again, I know this isn't everyone. But if we looked at, we have this full day. We have some children who are with us for 8, 9, 10 hours a day, depending on our program setup. If we could say, okay, if I do have to do story times, whatever, but I can do that at any part of the day. I could sit down and invite children to join me for this story time. I could have this activity that the curriculum says I have to do available all day long, and children can, I can do it in small groups, or children can come and go, whatever, instead of, I think that's one baby step, I think, is to look at your 9 to 11 time. And is that when you're chopping things up because you have so much to do? And then at least
is that my play teacher time, right? Putting my teacher hat on.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, well, and that'll go back to an investigation of your values, right? Yeah. Because I think that, I mean, I remember early when I was still teaching in a center, early years of being in a center, and that there were certain teachers that would get really miffed if the grownups didn't bring their kids in time for circle.
Yeah,
right?
Because they're going to miss out on learning. Yeah.
They're going to miss out on learning. And even then, when I was young, dumb, and stupid and didn't know any better, I'm like, who's to say they're only learning from 9 to 9:30? Like, what the heck's going on the rest of the day, right?
Yeah.
So to think, even that's a control piece, to think that there's only learning happening, you know, at certain times of day.
Yeah.
And why is it that we become okay with, like, free choice and all that after lunch, you know, where's that coming from?
And here's what drives, another thing that drives me crazy about that. Well, you have to be here at 9 because that's the most important stuff, whatever. At the end of the day, if we know that a parent got off at 3:30, but they're not there to pick them up right at 4, we're so mad. Those parents don't want to spend any time with their children, whatever. But in the morning, we don't want you spending that extra time with your child because we need you here at 9 for learning time.
And you know what? I'm going to pause right there because I am quite confident that most people have never stopped to think about that little bit of a discrepancy there, right? Yeah. Right. Whereas I would have time in the morning because maybe I go to work a little bit later or something like that. Like,
We value different times of the day in different ways. And that impacts so much of the rest of what we do. But I think that's
why nobody wants to be the closer.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Same type of thing. I want to be the opener because that's when all the good stuff happens.
Yep. Like, yep. I'm a lead teacher.
Where did all of these myths come from?
Yeah.
That would be fun to unpack that a little.
Yeah.
I would say if you had to sum it up, that control means essentially that you do it the way that I want it. Okay. And having structure means that, you know, that there might be a routine around, right. around yeah. it.
Yeah, I do think that that predictability of knowing what happens next does contribute to that sense of safety, does contribute to that feeling of, I have a little bit of agency just in knowing what's next. I don't have to wait for you to tell me what's next.
And I think detoxing,
and that can happen in a free play day. You can still have that.
100%. And that's why in the book, I walk people through that chopped up 20-minute schedule to a little bit more flexible schedule to what would actually have to happen if the door opened at 7 and you said, good morning, come on in, and you left when you got picked up. And maybe there might be some hard stops, you know, maybe lunch for whatever reason is at a certain time. But I've even said before, you know, to directors who jokingly, they're like, oh my God, Lisa, you're like, come work for us. You know, and I'm like, you know, there would have to be some hard conversations. What are the non-compromisables? And then I need to gauge your non-compromisable with where I am philosophically and in my own career, right? So if I went and got a job working at a childcare center and they told me that circle time had to be from 9:30 to 10, you know, I might push back a little bit harder on that. Mm-hmm. But if they told me that I had to be outside from 10 to 11, but the rest of the day was pretty much carte blanche, like that may not be the hill I die on. You know what I'm saying? You have to figure out where your compromise point is without sacrificing the integrity of what you claim that you believe in.
Or looking at, well, what's my goal of circle time? Because I'm thinking that 30, I mean, I know you did this, 30 minutes of circle time for anyone under 5 is too much.
Too much.
But if someone says to me, you have to do it, I'm going to say, why do I have to do it? What's the goal? Yeah. I figure out what that goal is. And I look at my whole day and I say, how else can I do that? Where else can this fit? How else is that already naturally happening?
Exactly.
And make that case. So in some cases, it's we have to practice, develop our own skill, our own understanding, and then practice saying that to people. So that
it's that working backwards that I teach people in the Wolf Workshop. You state for me your goals and objectives, and I can show you how you're already doing that during that 40-minute block of time that you call free play, which could be stretched. So let's work on stretching that.
Yeah.
You start to see the true potential of what's happening during that time frame that might be just beginning. What's the word I'm looking for? Like, push on. Like, oh, it's just free play. Oh, it's just free play. Free play is probably the most valuable time for
it
an adult
be the most
to be observing.
Of the time.
And it should be most of the time, if not
and
all
so
of the time.
One thing that that I used to do, and this came from when I was a center director, but I talk about it with, you know, the teachers that are in my classes and stuff now. When I did tours for parents who were looking at the center. And it was going to be during a free play time, and you know, that I knew that I'd be popping into that classroom. I could say to the family that was walking down the hall with me, it's going to look like it's out of control because it's 24 5-year-olds being children together in a room. It's like, so instead of looking at the whole room, look at groups. What are these two children engaged with? What are those three children engaged with? There's like moments of control in there. You know, there's moments of that structure they're looking for in there. You just have to, like, we have to foreground it for them. Look at these two. They're very engaged and focused. Look at these three. They're very engaged and focused. Look at this one over here. Listen to this conversation that's happening over there. So we just have to really develop our skill in identifying the value of the person we imagine is coming in to criticize us about this choice. And how can I then make what's happening fit their expectation in an appropriate, you know, developmentally informed way?
He who controls the language controls the debate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's why I'm going to even take what you just said as a scenario a step further. Yeah. I never would plant a seed in a parent's head that they might be walking into seeing something that might look a little bit chaotic and out of control. I am going to err on the side. And I think you age into this, right? Sure. You do. You learn how special mouth and I do not assume that anybody's having a problem with it. I'm going to assume that they're going to say something if they're a little concerned. And so I'm going to wait to see what is the vibe. What is the vibe as we walk into the free play time with 4 and 5 year olds and let, you know, I'm going to read their body language. I'm going to be see, and I might then plop in and see, you know, let me draw your attention to the 4 kids over there, you know, trying to find the corner piece of the puzzle. So then I'm going to dial it in. I'm going to point out what I want them to see and give them language that I want them to start using.
So I'm not going to argue with that. I think that's, you know, whatever. But I guess I want to go back to the why I would do it that way, where I acknowledge that reality is because I feel like managing expectations is really powerful. It's the same for me as if I was enrolling a child who was one, and this family had never had their child in care or a group situation before. And I would talk about biting, and I would say, you know, a reality of being in a toddler room is biting, you know, they might get bit or they might bite. And I like to talk to parents about that before it happens, rather than waiting until there's a bite and suddenly they are all freaked out.
That makes sense.
I guess I get what you're saying about how that guides them to focus on it when they might not see it that
way. But I might use specific words like you would, like you just did. Ooh, I like this. Like with how you do with an infant room. You're not going to say it's kind of crazy and chaotic. You're going to say, you know, you've got 15 kids together. They get bit. Yeah. They get hit, right? They get tripped on by accident. We're walking into a 4 and 5 year old room and it's going to be loud and it's going to
say,
you know what I'm saying? Like, so it's a vocabulary choice, but it's still going to be doing the same exact thing.
I might not say, really, I might not have said it's going to look like chaos, but you know, I would have framed it to the actual parent a little bit different than that. You're right. But I think there's, I don't know. I think both things could be valuable approaches, meaningful approaches.
I just know we sometimes use too many words because we're afraid we have to defend what we know
right before we really
needs to be happening.
Yeah.
And we splain. I mean, I think you've heard me tell the story of the 3-hour tours my staff used to give to parents. And I'm like, why are they taking 3 hours? But they were like opening the door and not getting defensive, but they were like justifying everything that was happening. Uh-huh. They were assuming that the parents, prospective parents, were going to have an issue with what they were seeing. So they were trying to get 3 steps ahead of it. And what they ended up doing was planting seeds that somehow what was happening here wasn't really supposed to be happening. And we're like, okay, we need to, you know, dial it back a little bit, you know, and let's figure out a dance that, you know, because it is sometimes loud and crazy. And if you're looking at the whole, it's like a Where's Waldo picture and you miss the forest for the trees because you're, you know, and a lot of times you're bombarded initially with the auditory, right? Vroom.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our vision, we're not necessarily locking on some of the more minutiae.
Yeah.
I think.
Imagine going in to like a busy restaurant as an adult to hang out with your friends. We wouldn't walk into a restaurant that was kind of loud and say, this is out of control. I need more structure to be able to.
That's a great analogy.
But for some reason, it's because we have this mindset. Our default is adults should be in control of children.
Yes.
And until we can kind of make that, I'm going to call it implicit bias, until we can make it explicit and talk about it like this, like, okay, what does it mean? Do we need to be in control of them? Do we need to have, like, what does it really mean when we say children need structure?
It means that I want people to think that when they walk in the room, I have a handle on the situation and that children, but again, this goes back to your own values and how you were raised, right? If you did what mama said, or you got a smack, and that's all you got in your experience, you're going to have a, whether you can articulate it or not, your body has an expectation mm-hmm. that might be at war literally with now what you know your role is working with young children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say that I joke about it, but I don't joke about it. Everybody who works with young children needs to go to therapy for a little bit of time, because even the most well-adjusted person who thinks they don't got any issues, you go hang out in a toddler room for 10 days, you'll find issues. The yeah. toddlers will find issues that you did not know you had. And it triggers. And then we're like, oh, shoot, where'd that? I mean, it's all so interrelated. And that's one of the things I love about talking with you guys and the Nerd Collective, is that we reinforce the notion, the belief that nothing is standing alone with when working mm-hmm. with children. You cannot like only look at one thing. You can start like we do today. We're going to talk about control versus structure. But just the minute you start talking, you realize that it's impossible to ignore all of the other variables that influence your perception and understanding of control and structure. Right. It's impossible.
Right, right. I think one of the things that was hard for me, and I'm comfortable being a reflective teacher. I don't remember a moment where I was like, oh, this is what reflecting on my practice means. I don't know what that is. But so at any rate, especially when I was a director, a child care center director, but even now as a college instructor, I'm always surprised that that doesn't just come naturally to people, that if I say, let's write a reflective piece or reflect on why, you know, here's what I think. Okay, why do you think that? It's really hard for a lot of people. And we almost have to, it's a skill we need to develop, this kind of reflection that you and I are talking about, asking why and looking at, you know, our body, our physical reaction to something, and what might that mean? And how might all of these things be interconnected? And why is it more complicated than just saying, well, they need structure, so here's my schedule. You know what I mean? It's hard for a lot of people.
I can only speak for myself. Mine was when Cindy Scrimger, and I don't know where you are in the early childhood world these days, Miss Cindy, but Cindy, it was a person. And I think probably for a lot of us, it was a person who either said something that we had never heard before or interacted with the kids in a way we'd never seen done before. And we steal it because it all of a sudden, it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And then you do something else.
Yeah.
And then you do something else. And very quickly, as I got to know Cindy, she became my real mentor. Many of you know the story. And, you know, she just started asking me, what is the worst possible thing that's going to happen? And I mean, Cindy offered scaffolding for me as an adult, right? With my ZPD, this is what I'd been doing by myself. But now with Cindy throwing out these verbal provocations, she got me literally to stretch out of my comfort zone. And that is the question that is literally 100%. I mean, we could flesh it out, but really it comes down to starting to ask what is the worst possible thing that's going to happen, and then allowing myself to be accountable for answering it.
Yeah.
And then starting to make small behavior changes once I realized, you know, that there is nothing bad. I just might not like it. Right. So now we can start shedding. Well, I just don't want it to happen. Well, you know, I don't want a lot of things to be happening. Right. But yeah. I'm not the boss of it.
So can we talk a little bit? I have no idea how long we've been talking.
I have about 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope we can do this in 10 minutes, but what are some of the reasons for moving away from that 20-minute chunked up adults always in control schedule? Like, do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, boom, boom, boom. We could bullet point this.
Yeah.
In a show without a lot of verbiage attached to it, just like a more bullet point, is 20 minutes is not enough time. Kid time is different than adult time. Yeah. You know, we all know it takes kids time to get into the day. You know, you say you have 20 minutes to go play. Some kids are going to be walking around the room looking for the shoe. Some kids are going to be walking around looking for Heather, you know, and by the time they finally get involved with something, and we're ringing the cleanup bell, right? Yeah. The chopped up schedule does not take into consideration the pre-play planning, mm-hmm. you know, nor does it take into consideration at the other end of children deciding when the play has come to its own yeah. conclusion, right? Yeah. Now play is stopping because we're ringing a bell.
Yeah. I think even beyond, I mean, of course, I would love it if play was all they were thinking about as they're listening to this. But even if it's your planned activities or whatever, it's not enough time for them to all really get engaged. It's not enough time for you to differentiate for the children who need differentiating.
Exactly.
It's actually teaching children not to focus because they're interrupted. So
we don't have enough time. So just scoot over. So I'll do it because I got 10 more kids that got to come up to the table.
Yeah.
And do it.
And a lot of that comes from that place of wanting them to be school ready. But one of the school readiness things is to be able to focus for long periods of time on their work or whatever. And we're teaching them for their first 5 years. Don't get too involved because we're going to change you here in a couple minutes.
We're going to change. And you know what? We don't have enough time, so I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah. I think the other thing is there's so many transitions that children have to make and that we're trying to take them through when it's chopped into those regimented small time period schedules. And then so often when I hear people ask me questions about behavior, it comes because we're trying to keep a child involved in something they're not interested in or ready for, or it comes during transition times.
Yes. And that goes back to what I said a few minutes ago, also about the fact that it's impossible to think that you're only doing a quote unquote math activity and you got blinders on, and that's not how somehow also influencing all of the other domains and curricular areas. It's very narrow, very, that's so narrow.
Yeah. Yeah. So the last thing that I'll add to this list then is I think it has an impact on children's mental health to be that regimented, to say you can only do what we say you can do when you can do it. For the first, 5 years of that child's life or whatever, if they're in a childcare program since they were babies, their days are, you'll do what I say when I say it, and your body will be where I want your body to be when I say it, when I tell you.
But then we expect them to be assertive and resilient
and
when they get into middle school.
Yeah. But they spend their whole days having no agency except do you want the red cup or the blue cup? You know what I mean?
We
think
choice.
That's enough, and it's not. And I think that's a big piece of depression and anxiety, is that feeling like I don't have any internal control over what's happening.
Internal locus of control. Yeah. Yes. Which we want to be cultivating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, one of the things that I was very proud of myself, I reread a lot of the book today, getting ready for this little chapter. And, and one of the things that I, because once you publish the book, right, and then you're like, I don't want to look at this for a little bit of time, and you go back, and I think one of the things that I was really super mindful of was showing throughout the book how it is all so interrelated.
Absolutely.
And I had forgotten in the intro, I even said, I don't want you doing anything new in your classroom or in your program until you've read the book all the way through. Mm-hmm. Finish the book and then start making some entry point plans of attack baby steps that's going to work for you and your particular program. But you can't ignore the relationship piece, the trust piece, the being developmentally appropriate piece, self-reflection piece. You are not going to be able to take any leaps forward in the control versus structure thing if you have not taken the time to reflect and do some internal work on your own personal, definitions of what that looks like and what that means. And that's why it was important for me to do the scenarios in the book. Like, these are actual things that I know you deal with on a daily basis. This is what it looks like from a control lens. And this is what it looks like with a structure being a facilitator lens.
Yeah. Well, everybody buy the book if you don't have it already. That'll be our wrap up. And thanks, Lisa.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad we got to squeeze this in.
Me too. Always, always, always so glad to talk to you.
And I want you to go rest your voice and feel
I know,
better.
Yeah, that's what I was like. I have to go pee and I need to rest my voice. So we're gonna wrap this one up.
All right, thanks for having me.
Yep, bye Lisa. Bye everybody. Okay. Thanks for listening to another episode.
And that's the show. Now go get your nerd on.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.